Thank you. And a great thanks to the organizers of this workshop for inviting me. The advantage of talking on the last day of the workshop is that you don't have to define anything, because everything has been defined by previous speakers. So I won't be defining anything, except I will define what a pattern is. A pattern is some P, which consists of P, Q, E1, and E2. And P and Q are digraphs. And E1, E2 are some homomorphisms from P to Q. And now for any pattern T like this, I will define some kind of a construction phi P, which will take a digraph and create a new digraph. So from now on, whenever I say graph, I will mean digraph. Whenever I mean graph, I will say symmetric graph. And the vertices of, if you apply it to G, no, I want to apply it to H. So the vertices of this will be all homomorphisms from P to H. And the edges of this will be all pairs of F and G. So these are pairs of homomorphisms from P to H, such that there exists some homomorphism H that goes from Q to H. And if you go from P using E1, I should call it a formula, to Q, and then you go to H, when you go to H using this H, what you get as composition is F, so this diagram commutes. And if you go from P to Q using E2, and then using H to H, then what you get is G. Okay, now I've confused everyone, so I can start explaining things. Example one. This will be some kind of a symmetrization. Okay, so the P will be just one vertex, and this means that when you then do the phi of P, the graph you get will have the same vertices as H had, and Q will be K2. Okay. So what does it mean, this example? Okay, you start with some digraph. It has some arcs. So this is your H, and with this particular P, let's call it P of H, what you will get is, well, the vertices will be homomorphisms from one vertex to this graph, so this will be just the vertices of H, will be the same thing, and you'll get an arc if you can map a symmetric edge between two vertices. So in this case, you would get this arc, because you can, oh, I didn't tell you what the E1 and E2 are. So E1 takes this vertex to this vertex, and E2 takes it to the other one. So you will get this arc by mapping Q in this way, but you also get the backward arc by mapping it in the reverse order. And the edges that are not symmetric will just disappear. So you'll get some kind of a symmetric. So from any graph, you will get a symmetric one. Yes? No. Yeah, but you cannot map. Well, if you had a loop here, you would get a loop here. But there is no way to map K2 onto this vertex, so that there's no homomorphism that takes both E1 and E2 to this vertex. Example 2 is the arc graph. And I will call it delta, because so delta will stand for this phi of this particular P. So this is P1, this is P2. And here, P is this graph, Q is this graph, and E1 takes the edge to the lower edge, and E2 takes it to the upper edge. Okay. So what do we get from here? Well, the construction basically means you replace every edge with a vertex. So you take one vertex, for this edge, for this edge, for this edge, this edge, and for the loop, if you like. And for any two consecutive edges like that, you put an edge in the arc graph. So these are consecutive. These two are consecutive both ways, so there will be two edges like that. Now, this and this are consecutive. The loop is consecutive with both and with itself. Is anything missing? I don't think so. Right. So this would be the delta of H. Okay. Is that clear to anyone? It's kind of like the line graph, but an oriented version. How much more time do I have? So the example 3 is exponential structure. So this is defined for graphs F and H. H to the F has vertices. All mappings, so F is now all mappings from the vertex set of F to the vertex set of H. This is the usual definition of an exponential graph. And the edges of this exponential thing our FG, such that whenever UV is an edge of F, then F on U and G on V is an edge of H. So this is something you might have seen before. This exists. And it has many uses. Now, how does this fit into the pattern example? Well, the pattern will be taken to be the empty graph on the vertex set of F. Okay, so I will construct such a P for any fixed given F. Okay. So the pattern will be the empty graph, so the isolated vertices, one for each vertex of F. And the Q will be two copies of this. Okay. E1 will take P here. E2 will take it there. So each of these vertices corresponds to a vertex of F, and if here you would put F, you would get some arcs like that, and so on. So now into the Q, whenever there is an arc of F, so this is F, I will put one like this. Here I will put one downwards, because there's a downwards, and here I will put one downwards, and things like that. So now you can check that the general definition of the pattern that I gave you actually produces this power graph or the exponential graph. Okay. Example 4. It's the interlacing adjoint. Or the kth interlacing adjoint. So it has a parameter which is a positive integer k. It has to be at least two, because if it's one, then it's not interesting. And this will be called yota k. So the p for this yota k will be k vertices, for example 3. And the Q will be a path on 2k vertices. So it doesn't fit. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And now, E1 takes the three vertices to these three vertices. So this is E1. And E2 takes it to the remaining three vertices. So these are the images of P under E1 and E2. Okay. So in human language, the vertices of the kth interlacing adjoint of some H will be the vertices of H to the K, so all K tuples, because all homomorphisms from this are just all K tuples of the vertices. And the edges of this will be U1, UK, V1, VK, such that while U1 has an edge to V1, has an edge to U2, and so on, UK, VK. Any questions? So everybody's sleeping already. Good. So why is this called, why is this talk called adjoint functors? Well, because these are adjoint functors. Well, adjoint to what? Adjoint to stars. Okay, so for a pattern P, I will now define a different construction. I don't really want to define it. So this will now act on some G. And the vertices, oh no, not the vertices. So this is okay. So this is I won't be writing it formally. I will just write what it means. So this will be constructed from G. We will take a copy of P for every vertex of G. And now the idea is that what we want is that is that ideally every edge of G would correspond to a copy of Q in this graph, because we're trying to construct something like an inverse to what we had. So what we will do, what we have to do is for every edge of G, we have to identify vertices in this disjoint union of the copies vertices that correspond to the intersections, or well, that correspond to the images of some vertex in T under E1. I will show on the examples what it means. And also for every edge of G, we will add some edges so that we would get a copy of this Q where we want it. Okay, and I will say a theorem. And I won't explain it. So this theorem is by Aleš Pulter in 1970, and by Nešetil, Cardiff, and me in 2009. No, sorry, it's not Nešetil. It's only Cardiff and me in 2009. Which says that all pairs of adjoint functors in the category of digraphs and homomorphisms are like this. Okay, so the theorem splits into two parts. Poulter proved that all right adjoints are like this, And we proved that our left adjoints are like that. He was probably not interested in the left ones. So now let's get back to the examples. Okay, so this is not the, this is quite clear. Oh, I could return to something like that again. Okay, so now, so this is G. And now we want this phi of G. So P was just one vertex, so we will take one vertex for every vertex of G. So that's the first step up there. And now for every edge, like this one, we will put a copy of Q basically. So we will put Q like this, we will put Q like this. Well, okay, for these two, and like that. Okay, so, this is the phi star, So what we will get is another symmetrization. Well, the first symmetrization was just forgot the edges that didn't have a symmetric counterpart, and this one, what it does is it adds the symmetric edge where there is one missing. Okay, so these two are adjoint functors. Now for the arc graph, I will go back to this and I will try to construct the arc graph of the green thing. That would be too complicated. I won't. I will construct the not the arc graph but the start one of this. So this is the this is G and delta star of G. Well, I will take one arc for every vertex here, so what I will start with something like that. Okay, and now because of this arc I will have to do some identification. So what I will identify is the end vertex of this with the starting vertex of this arc. Okay, so these two will be identified. And also these two will be identified because of this arc. So this exactly what I want is that what I have in G, an arc, that this would correspond to a copy of Q. And Q looks like that. Right? So this is Q. So I want that these two together would form a Q. So I have to identify these two. So what I will get is this path. So this is there. Now if I change the G, put an arc like that, the vertices, or well, I will start with three copies of P, which is one edge in this case. But now there are more identifications. Well, for this arc and this one, the identifications are up here. But for this one, I also have to identify this vertex with this vertex so that these two copies would form a copy. So these two arcs would form something resembling to Q. So what I will get in this case is by identifying everything here will look like that. Oh, I forgot to tell you what the adjoint functors means. So in case you don't know, adjoint functors means that the homomorphisms, okay, I will say it vaguely because I don't want to tell you really. So the homomorphisms from G to phi H are in a one-to-one correspondence with the homomorphisms from phi star of G to H. Okay. So there is a one-to-one correspondence between those homomorphisms. So in particular, what happens is that there exists one here, if and only if there exists one over there. Okay, so this will be the most important property. In this talk, I won't use the fact that there is a one-to-one correspondence between them and that they compose in the right way and so on and so on. I don't need that. Everything that I will need is just this equivalence. There is one from G to phi of H, if and only if there is one from phi star G to H. And so now I'm returning to example 3, where it is known that the product of F and G has a homomorphism to H, if and only if G has a homomorphism to H to the F. So this is a well-known property of exponentiation, or it might be even a definition of exponentiation, if you like. So how does it translate to our P's and Q's? Okay, so it looks like, well, the adjoints, they're not symmetric. This is the right one. It acts on the target graph. This is the left one. This acts on the source graph always. So this looks like if this is the right functor for a fixed F, this should be its left adjoint for a fixed F. Right? So let's see if we can get it from here. So this is the G, and there are some edges in G. Now, the start construction. Oh, I don't have any timer. The start construction. So the Q is, or the P is empty on F. So let's put F here. Okay. So what I will take is a copy of P. So these are just this is just the empty graph, so isolated vertices, one for each vertex of F. And now, for every edge of G, I will put in this Q. Okay. So this Q in this case is simple. It looks like this. Oh, for this edge, I will put the copy of Q, but reversed, so we'll get this. And for this edge, I will, this is too complicated. For this edge, I will get that. And you see that really what we're getting is the product of G and F. So who does know the definition of the product? No one knows. So the Libor knows. So the product the vertices is just the Cartesian product of the vertex sets and some UV is an edge of the product. Okay, so U1, V1, U2, V2 is an edge of the product if and only if U1, U2 is an edge of F and V1, V2 is an edge of G. And so you see that this is exactly what happens. Okay, I won't be talking about this interlacing adjoint for now, but I will return to it later. Now, What do we want to do with them? Let me see. So, so one thing that we could do about these things is try to determine the chromatic numbers. What is the chromatic number? Everybody knows. So K N is the graph which has N vertices, and it has edges, all pairs UV, such that U is different from V. So you see this, it's a digraph which has an edge going both ways between any two vertices. And the chromatic number of any H is equal to the minimum N such that H has a homomorphism to KN. Or you know it in terms of coloring, which is even better now. So now what I want to say is that the chromatic number of delta H for any H is at least the logarithm of the chromatic number of H. So I don't know whose theorem it is, but it's a kind of folklore. Or maybe it's a Nashutfield and someone, because everything in this area is Nashutfield and someone. Except for this. I didn't want to offend you. Okay, how do you prove this? Well, you prove it by saying that if you have, okay, how do you do it? If you have a coloring of, so you do it by proving, actually. I should have some proof. So the chromatic number of H is at most 2 to the chromatic number of delta H. And the way you do it is, okay, so you have some H, and for simplicity it looks like that. Now you have a coloring of delta H, so that's like an edge coloring of H. And so what you will do is, so you will have some color 1 here, color 2 here, color 3 here, or something like that. What you will do is color every vertex with the set of colors on incoming edges, okay, and then you will get it. And you can check that this is a proper coloring of the delta, and this proves, of the H, and this proves this inequality, which is equivalent. Moreover, delta of Pn, so the transitive tournament on n vertices, so this looks like that. This is T4. It has n vertices and edges all going one way, upwards. So this does not contain any triangles or the symmetrization of it. So this is the symmetrization of this graph. So this symmetrization, the one that adds edge for any missing. Okay, the symmetrization contains no triangles. Okay, so if you take n large enough, you will get a graph with an arbitrary large chromatic number containing no triangles. And if you do it k times, so you do delta, 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 and so on, of Tn, then the chromatic number of this will be at least log, and so on, of n. so huge. If n is... And... I'm running out of time. I have no time left. And there won't be any short odd cycles. So each delta destroys one size of odd cycles, and you get a construction of graphs with a huge chromatic number and no short odd cycles. To get a construction with no cycles and a large chromatic number, that's a bit more tricky and involved, but if you're fine with short odd cycles, then this is what you can use. Okay, now a theorem by Ye and Zhu of 2005, I think, is that the circular chromatic number of the kth interlacing adjunct of Pn is equal to n over k. Okay, so in particular, the chromatic number of the same thing is equal to the ceiling of n over k. Proof of Ye and Zhu goes by taking the symmetrization of this. Okay, so again, this is the one that adds edges where they're missing, and shows that there is a homomorphism there and back to the circular clique on n vertices with parameter k. So in fact, there's more to it than just the chromatic number. There's just the circular chromatic number. There is an equivalence of these two. What is the circular clique? Well, the vertices of the circular clique. Do I have to tell you? No, I shouldn't tell you. Oh, well, anyway. So the vertices of the circular clique. These are just n. So 1 to n. And there's an edge. UV is an edge of the circular clique. If and only if the difference is at least k, but the difference is measured on the circle or in cyclic distance, so this is at most n minus k. So. Okay, so if you take k equal to 1, you will just get the normal clique, the complete graph. If you take k larger, then we'll get this. And but you know all this from Xuding's talk. Okay, so now we have some chromatic numbers. Now, if I had more time, I would say why what they used it for. They used it for some fair scheduling of processes on graphs and things like this. But I have no time, so I won't tell you. What I will tell you, though, is something that is not interesting for the algebra people at all. And that is that phi p preserves all, what they call it, the Maltsev operations, or the Maltsev-like operations. So if you don't know what the Maltsev-like operation is, don't worry. But if you do, well, what I mean by this is that if H has some polymorphism f that satisfies f of x, y, z, or x, something like this, identically f of y, z, x, x, or any condition that you have, that you can think of, then so has phi t of h. So what it means for CSPs is that if H has some nice algorithm or some nice algorithm that is that you can tell from the variety of polymorphisms or the you know, then also phi of P of H has it. Okay, so in particular, if CSP H is, and now we fill in something, then so is CSP of phi P H. Okay, and this something that you can fill in here is data log or symmetric data log or bounded with or tree duality or so with one and so on. So what I will look at in the remaining 40 minutes is this. And I will show you a theorem, which is okay. Now it's really necessary. And Tardif and myself it's probably 2011 if Elsevier does everything right. Now, what the theorem is that for any G, there is a homomorphism to the kth interlacing adjoint of Tn if and only if P has no homomorphism to G for any P in P n k minus 1. So I should also tell you what this P n k minus 1 is, because otherwise the theorem makes little sense. And P n k minus 1 is the set of all oriented paths constructed from the directed path on n with n edges, so Pn, this will be the path with n edges, 1, 2, n, going all the same way, by reversing at most k minus 1 arcs or edges. So if you start with 3 and you reverse 1, what you will get is upwards, downwards, upwards. So this would be in P3-1, but that's not very interesting. Sorry? Oh. I didn't reverse. I did reverse it because I always draw all edges going upwards. Thank you. Well, let's see if I manage. So the easy part of the proof I will skip, and that is that if P is in this set, then P has no homomorphism to IKTN. Well, that proves one implication by composition of homomorphism. The second implication is more involved, and that says that if G has no homomorphism to IKTN, then I will find some path in this set which has a homomorphism to it, so which prevents really G from being homomorphic to the adjoint. Right. Okay. So how shall we do it? Start with this. G has now homomorphism to IKTN. What does it mean? Well, there was the definition somewhere. It's not here anymore, is it? Anyway, so this means that IK star of G has no homomorphism to Pn. But from Galois-Roy theorem, or from the Poulter and Neschitzel-Poulter theorem, and things like this that you heard about in Jarek's talk about first-order definable CSPs, you know that this is equivalent to Pn having a homomorphism to I star K of G. So Pn is, again, it's the directed path with n edges. So what is I star K of G? Well, now I can tell you. This is G, there are some edges. Okay. And we have K vertices isolated for every vertex of G. Oh, it should be, yeah, K. Exactly. And now the Q is still hiding somewhere here. No, it's up there. So the Q looks like this. Right? So what I do when I construct the starred thing of G is that I add all these edges that are missing between the, you know. So these are the E1s, E2s, E3s, and I have to add them. So it will be something like there is an edge here, so this causes the existence of these edges. There's an edge here, so this causes the existence of all these existences are caused from anyway, so this will be the Yotta star. And now you know that there is Pn somewhere in this. So what you do is you look at how it maps in here. And for instance, you will find it there. Okay, so this is a long directed path. But now you see that if you produce this mapping, this will be a homomorphism from Pn, but you have to reverse some edges. Namely, you have to reverse this edge and maybe some others. But oh, you have to reverse exactly the green edges, because the green edges are mapped in the wrong direction here. So so this gives a homomorphism with from some p in Pn, and then some number, but you don't know yet how many of the green edges you have to reverse, to g. Okay, but the number of reversed edges is at most k minus 1, because once you get to this level, you will never get down again, and once you get to this level, you will never get down again. So the number of green edges that you can use is at most k minus 1. So indeed, this can be replaced by k minus 1. Okay, and in the remaining minus two minutes, I will say what this theorem implies, and I will just rephrase the theorem in different terms. So I will say I will call it the circular Galilean theorem. Which follows from this theorem of Ye and Zhu and from our theorem, and it says that a graph, a symmetric graph, G, has the circular chromatic number at most n over k, if and only if it admits an orientation such that no path, an orientation, G orientation, no path from P n k minus 1 is homomorphic to it. And with this, I would like to end. Thank you.